You are listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Kirin's The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
Chapter 23. Deliani first noticed that Farlan had broken rank and was heading downward, then that he was riderless. Gazing down, to her horror, she saw Tally tumbling earthward. "Tally!" screamed Deliani, plunging her eidolon downward. Seeing what was happening, the others dove also. Farlan chased his mistress as fast as he could, but within moments she struck the ground. Touching down next to her, Deliani leapt from Manet and kneeled by her side. "Tally!" she cried, but the fallen girl, lying face down, did not move or make a sound. Speckerin landed, then Hutt, and they were immediately at her side. "Is she breathing?" asked Hutt. "Will she be all right?" The magician observed her closely, then gently felt her extremities, torso, neck, and head, and found no skeletal disruptions. "She's breathing. Whether she'll be all right, I don't know." He glanced about. "We are very fortunate. It could have been worse. We were flying lower than usual, and she fell onto a soft area of ground." He patted the grassy plot upon which she lay. A short distance in one direction was bare, hard ground, and in another were gravel and rocks. "I should have known this was coming," said Deliani. "It's the second time. I was behind Jilin when we lost him. Perhaps she shouldn't have been riding alone. Perhaps I should have been with her."
"No one's to blame," said Speckerin.
"We all knew she was exhausted. It happened so quickly, no one could have predicted or prevented it." That didn't console Deliani. Courageous as she was, tears welled in her eyes. Tally was lying in direct sunlight. The magician glanced about the sight, then pointed to the low-hanging boughs of a hemlock tree.
"We must move her into the shade."
Taking a piece of white cloth from her pack, Deliani spread it out smoothly in the place Speckerin had indicated. With utmost caution and carefully supporting her head, the three Kirins turned their limp companion over and lifted her off the ground. Next, they carried her to the shelter of the tree and laid her on the cloth. Then they waited. In his preparations with Duan the morning the party left Rogalinon, Speckerin included many items in his baggage. But he had limited space, and choices were made. Now, searching through his gear, he found only a few of the balms, potions, and antidotes employed by a magician in serving his clan. To his consternation, he had nothing to administer to Tally. Hutt discovered water nearby, and the magician applied a cool, moist compress to Tally's forehead and elevated her feet. Then he paced back and forth and uttered magical incantations he hoped might help. But he knew only one thing would truly help. In this remote a location, were Tally human, or from any number of species other than Kirin, nursing her and waiting for recovery would be all an attendant could do. If the trauma wasn't severe, the victim would recover. If the injury was grave, death would doubtless ensue. With Kirin's, as Speckerin well knew, the arrangement is different. Kirin's retain some of their ancestors' magic. It is essential for participation in race-wide magic, including Noan and Curlace, but also for normal daily function. Within each Kirin's soul, a fraction of magic burns like a flame. In Ruvan, it is called Eris, but like a candle's, this flame can be snuffed out. The race's magic has declined over time. Noan provides invisibility, but is not as powerful as it once was. Curlace, once purely magical, is now a combination of magic and training. But most significantly to Speckerin, pacing back and forth beside Tally, is that the critical core, the essence, the flame, has become more fragile over time. Thus, the survival of every Kirin is more tenuous than ever before. Kirin's fear bodily trauma, not only because of structural damage, Spekeren had examined Tally for that, but also because of the indwelling flame's fragility. Physical injury can cause this eris, essential for life, to decline. It can happen quickly and might be irreversible. Thus, the flame's revival must occur as soon as possible. Even before the accident, Spekeren was concerned about Tally's eris. Physical injury isn't the only thing that can harm it. Psychological injury can be just as damaging, and the pressures and punishment she was enduring were immense. When physical trauma was added, Spekeren knew, if she didn't recover rapidly, he must intervene. Every magician knows that a few precious substances in nature can fuel and rarely rekindle the vital flame. They can keep it burning, even in the face of severe damage, aiding incalculably to recovery. As evening drew nigh and Tally showed no sign of improvement, Spekeren acted. Wanting Deliani to stay close to nurse the lass, he dispatched Hutt to find a barwood tree. This mysterious tree has sap with the exact properties the magician was looking for. It can be life-saving or, if improperly administered, render irreparable harm. But Spekeren was painfully aware that wasn't the only problem. Harvesting it could also be hazardous. To save Tally, he decided to take the risk. By incredible luck, a large grove of the darkly hued trees was not far away. He had noted them a short time before Tally fell. Wanting to return to the grove himself, he was torn about what to do, and finally, for two reasons, selected Hutt. First, Spekeren was exhausted himself, but more importantly, in this time of Tally's need, he simply couldn't leave her side. Summoning Hutt, he described the tree's appearance and properties. Though rare in the home forest, the barwood was easily recognizable and known to Yorl and Mulgar Kirins. The lad listened only briefly before confirming he was acquainted with it. The unique bark appears to be a series of tubular rings horizontally encircling the trunk. But in fact, if following them around the tree, what seem to be many are but a single cylindrical structure, spiraling the trunk in the manner of a corkscrew. With the largest rings at the bottom, this hollow structure gradually narrows as it circles upward, then divides and spreads out over the boughs. These tubular veins carry sap. The leaves have their own potent qualities, but the sap has life-giving and life-threatening capabilities. No tree is difficult for Kirins to climb, but the barwood is easiest of all because of the ladder-like configuration of its surface. The deeply, enticingly colored leaves attract youthful Kirins, almost beckon them upward. But not a youth of the home clans has ever touched a barwood, taught from childhood about the tree's perils. Instructing Hutt what to do, Spekeren spoke quickly and with utter gravity.
"Climb the tree, gather several leaves, and place them in this container."
Removing a silver box from his bag, the magician's brow furrowed as he handed it to Hutt.
"Then climb down to the ground immediately. Do not tarry in the tree, little one. Puncture one of the trunk's vessels and collect a few drops of sap in this."
He produced a small silver vial.
"While anywhere near the tree," he continued, "wear a mask. Take this cloth and cover your face, leaving only your eyes exposed, and tie it tightly behind your head. Under no circumstances may the leaves, the sap, or fumes from the sap come near your face. The slightest ingestion or inhalation of untamed barwood liquor can be disastrous. Hasten back to us with your harvest. After it's modified, I will attempt to administer it to Tally."
Spekeren was fully aware that taming barwood sap in the wild and with precious little equipment would be difficult, if not impossible. Nonetheless, the first order of business was to procure it. The magician told Hutt where he had seen the barwood grove, due westward. Deliani called Lisam, and Hutt was quickly off. Having flown but a short while, he spied the unmistakable trees, laden abundantly with rust-brown leaves. Setting Lisam down in the middle of the grove, he dismounted and chose a large tree. There was no doubt about its identity, with the bark's circular ridging and the unique coloration of the leaves. Out came the cloth, and he tied it behind his head. Stepping up to the tree, he placed a long foot on one of the lower protuberances and began to climb. Kirins are at home in trees and dexterous when climbing. On this clear evening, after all they'd been through, it was a pleasure to be in the tree. Reaching a branch well above ground, he moved out cautiously toward the coveted leaves. He took a few moments to make his selection, beginning to notice, even through the mask, a pleasing and delicate scent. Choosing several leaves, each a perfect specimen, he thought, he placed them in the silver box, closed its top tightly, and returned it to his satchel. Then, whether due to youth, inexperience, curiosity, fatigue, the charm of the barwood grove, the insidious infiltration of its fumes, or a combination of everything, he found himself aware only of the beauty and solitude around him. Despite Spekeren's warnings, he sat down on the branch to enjoy a gold and purple sunset. Wondering whether the barwood was so evil after all, he even thought about taking off the mask, simply wanting a brief and peaceful interlude. Soon he realized he must be getting on about his business. He got to his feet and was moving toward the trunk when the branch appeared out of focus. The sensation cleared, but soon returned, this time more intensely. Able to edge his way back toward the trunk, he finally got there and clung to it, his balance impaired and his vision fuzzy. Feeling his way downward, he might easily have fallen had it not been for the bar-like protrusions. Reaching the ground, he could perceive little more than darkness and light. As he clutched the giant veins, he only vaguely recalled his mission. Taking the pruning knife unsteadily from his belt and the vial from his satchel, he wondered dimly whether, in his condition, he should carry out his orders. But, remembering Tally, he punctured the wall of a giant channel and felt warm liquor seeping therefrom. With effort, he maneuvered the vial into position. He managed to capture a small amount of the fragrant fluid, cap the container, and return it to his satchel before slowly crumpling at the foot of the tree. His final recollection, before losing all awareness, was of thick sap oozing from the hole, running down the trunk, and forming an aromatic pool beside him. Chapter 24. Spekeren and Deliani took turns watching over Tally throughout a long night, one made far longer because Hutt did not return. Many worries coursed through the old magician's mind, not the least of which were the perils young Hutt might be facing. With the earliest light of day, there was no change in Tally and no sign of Hutt. "Now one of us must go after him," said Spekeren, near desperation. "Will our fortunes never change? Look at us. You and I are the only ones left. This quest has been grossly unkind to all three youths. The barwood tree might have smitten Hutt. I must go. Call Ocalan." The magician was soon in the air, moving hastily westward, yellow robe flying. When he saw the grove of darkly colored trees, he descended among them and dismounted. Looking about, he could see no one, nothing, save the mysterious and alluring trees. "Hutt!" he called loudly. "Are you here? Can you hear me?" He strode swiftly through the trees, calling the lad's name. All at once he smelled barwood liquor. It had an unearthly and unforgettable fragrance, one he had smelled only once before in his lifetime. Then he saw a pool of sap at the foot of a nearby tree, its source an oozing wound. "That must be where Hutt made his cut," thought Spekeren, who dared not venture closer because of the intoxicating liquid. But where is the lad? Why did he not return with the sap? Where is Lisam? They're gone. Nearly at wit's end, and with no idea where to search, he climbed onto Ocalan. He flew back toward the hemlock tree, searching the terrain along the way, seeing no sign of hut or Lisam. Landing near the hemlock, he told Deliani what he had found. "The powers of Barwood might have overcome him," murmured the magician. "But if so, why wasn't he by the tree? And what about Lisam? If Hutt could still direct her, where would they have gone but here? If he were dead, she'd have returned without him. I know neither what's happening nor what to do. Our party's been broken tragically asunder. I wasn't built for this kind of strife." Slumping on a log next to Tally, his head in his hands, he remained there, unmoving, inconsolable, Deliani trying to comfort him until the sun was high in the sky. All at once, a raven glided in, landing nearby, no rider aboard. "Spekeren!" cried Deliani, running to the bird. "Lisam's back! Hut's not with her!" The dazed magician rose unsteadily and moved to examine the bird. There was no evidence of her young master. Spekeren knew what that meant. Every Kirin did. When a Kirin dies, his or her Eilon senses it no longer has a master. If this happens away from home, the Eilon is taught to return home and lead others to the body. "Lisam returned alone," Spekeren said, turning away. "She returned alone," he repeated several times over, shattered to the core. Chin quivering, he looked at Deliani, and his next words came with extreme difficulty. "Hut is dead. She must lead us to him." Sitting down wearily, he stared at Lisam, Deliani trying vainly to console him. "This exploration's at an end," he moaned. "It's failed. I simply couldn't hold things together. The forces against us were too great. The party's disintegrated, has been decimated, and it all occurred so early." It was the lowest point in his life. And now, deep in his heart, priorities began to change. The survival of those who remained was more important than the mission, whatever that might have been. Jilin was gone. Raydel was exceedingly far away. Unless Tally recovered, they had no one to direct them. It was over. For the first time since departure, he considered going home, and even how they would transport Tally on the way. A shrill voice speaking Ruvan rang out behind him. "I see you already have one dead lad. Behold, I bring his brother to your hemlock tree." Chapter 25. Staring at the small human girl, Jilin didn't know what to think. "She can't be looking at me. She's looking at something nearby." He didn't move a muscle, afraid he might make a sound or cause a leaf or flower to move, and she'd somehow detect him. Nonetheless, she continued gazing directly at him and soon knelt down as if to have a closer look. With lifelong training, the frightened Jilin stood motionless, uttering not a sound. "Why are you standing so still?" asked the girl. "What's your name?" Only a short distance away, Ruggum couldn't see his young companion and couldn't tell exactly what was happening. But he was greatly disturbed because the human appeared to be scrutinizing the area where he thought Jilin to be. "Hello," she said. Ruggum was no expert in English, but knew what that meant, and became even more alarmed when she kneeled down. "Why are you standing so still?" she asked. "What's your name?" Ruggum had an appalling thought. Could she somehow actually be seeing him? "Of course not. She's looking at something near him, and he's trapped in the area. I must get her attention." He thought of the trick he had played when humans were taking the moral mushrooms from Baron and Hutt. Making any movement in the presence of a human went against everything he had been taught. But in this predicament, he took a chance. With head and hand gestures, he summoned Alcinom. The intelligent old raven cocked his head and observed his master, and with his head still tilted, began plodding toward Ruggum. The large bird's movement immediately caught the girl's eye. She stood up, her glance going back and forth between Jilin and the bird. As the raven approached, Ruggum gave further visual commands. Stopping, the Eilon watched his master closely. Then, turning toward the girl, the bird opened his beak, and from it poured a song as beautiful as one might hear. Unlike the humans at the Moral site, this young one didn't flee. She was filled with curiosity and wonder, smiling, staring, and listening with rapt attention. Her gaze away from him, Jilin seized the opportunity, ran to the nearest tree, and hid behind the trunk. As soon as the song ended, the girl's eyes darted back to where he had been. "Where are you?" she asked, bending down and searching. "I saw you. Where did you go? I won't hurt you. I just want to talk to you."
"Sandra," called her father, climbing up from the pond and looking about. "There you are. What are you doing? Where'd the music come from? I didn't see you bring your radio."
"I saw something," said the little girl, not taking her eyes off the place Jilin had been. "A little person with big feet. The music came from that bird." She pointed at Alcinom.
"Just a crow, honey. They don't sing. They just croak and caw. What about the music?"
"It came from the bird." The man took his hat off and scratched his head.
"Want to do some fishing?"
"No, I saw a little man right there, and I want to see him again." After a bit more discussion, the man led his daughter by the hand toward the pond. Until she was out of sight, her head remained turned, and she gazed in the direction of the Kirins and their birds.
"Jilin," whispered Ruggum, "they're gone. Where are you?"
Shaken by the inexplicable confrontation, Jilin cautiously left his hiding place and moved toward the elder, who waited anxiously between the two ravens.
"I'm here," said the lad. Ruggum turned toward the sound.
"Are you all right?"
"Yes," said Jilin. But he wasn't. Beads of sweat stood on his forehead. He understood enough English to know what she had said. She was looking at me. She couldn't actually have seen me, could she?
"Of course not," snapped the overseer. "Never. We have been invisible for thousands of years. She was looking at something near you, perhaps even behind you. It was pure coincidence that you were there."
"Then what did she mean by little man and big feet and standing so still?"
"She was looking at a bird, an animal, a squirrel, possibly a frog which has large feet. She might have been playing a game with the man because she didn't want to go with him. But, my young friend, be assured of one thing. She could not have seen you."
"Unless," thought the overseer with a jolt, "Jilin had used the only means by which a Kirin can become visible, that single flaw in Noan. But how would he have known what to do? And it would be so unthinkable, no average Kirin could do it."
"But," Ruggum reminded himself, "Jilin is hardly average. Perhaps the isolation caused by carrying the knowledge, the attack by the Granum, his separation from the other party, and his invisibility among family, friends, and race had all combined to bring him to a breaking point, and he did something rash and totally out of character."
"Please don't take this the wrong way," said Ruggum, choosing his words carefully. "But when the human came near you, did you sense any sort of, I'm sorry to even ask, enjoyment or pleasure?"
Jilin responded angrily.
"Of course not. I was scared to death. Enjoyment? Why would you say such a thing?"
They were alone and far from home. The information Ruggum might now impart would go no further, and he decided to reveal the secret.
I will tell you something very few know about. The only way a Kirin can be seen by a human is for the Kirin to desire to be seen and to will himself visible. Such cases are rare, but have happened.
Are you suggesting? What kind of Kirin would do that after the way they've treated us?
I don't know, said Ruggum, shaking his head, chagrined at having asked and hoping it wouldn't alter their relationship. Neither wanted to discuss the matter further. Having no desire to spend the night here now, they mounted their Eilon and departed, the sun setting behind them. Jilin was haunted by what had happened, unable to get the image of the girl out of his mind, and chafing over Ruggum's inference. The elder, becoming more and more uneasy, debated inwardly about what happened to Jilin.
Is it possible the human really saw him?
Absolutely not, unless he willed it. Yet she described him in detail. If only I could see him, I could do a better job of protecting him. If only the Granum hadn't captured him.
Thinking of the Granum, an onerous idea shook Ruggum.
Could the beast's sting have caused a gruesome reversal, making him invisible to Kirins but visible to humans?
Shuddering at the thought, Ruggum tried to remain outwardly calm. The last thing he wanted to do was to alarm his young friend further, but he continued mulling it over.
Visible to humans. Combined with invisibility to Kirins, that would be a harsh penalty for carrying the knowledge. We'll not know whether it's true until we encounter another human, a highly unlikely occurrence.
Neither of them spoke, but Ruggum's ruminations were intruded upon by an overbearing need to find a place for the night. It was past dusk. They had flown later than usual. Stars were in a clear sky above. Searching the terrain for a suitable site, he saw something in the distance, and at first didn't know what. Blinking and scattered across the landscape were pinpoint dots of light, single and in clusters. Then he knew what they were and was not surprised. The humans they had encountered were hardly an isolated pair. Humanity was social and societal. The appearance of two only meant the proximity of others, possibly many others, and what they were approaching was a sizable settlement of the giant beings.
Kirins, The Spell of Noan, written and narrated by James D. Priest.
To learn more about Kirins, visit www.kirinbooks.com.
You have been listening to A Good Book on Sun Sounds of Arizona.